You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, we're going to look at a topic that has seen its share of headlines lately, child sexual abuse. Earlier this month, Florida passed a new law meant to toughen penalties for sex offenders in the state. The law establishes mandatory sentences of 25 years to life for certain child molesters and would require some abusers released from jail to wear trackable ankle bracelets for the rest of their lives. The law in Florida comes in response to two recent murders of young girls in the state. Other states are following Florida's lead. New York is considering changes to the way that state deals with convicted offenders, as is Georgia. But will these laws help to prevent sex abuse? What do we know about those that abuse? Are they mentally ill? Are there treatments that might help them? Or is locking them away for life really the only answer? These are some of the questions we'll be talking about this hour. And if you'd like to get in on the discussion, I invite you to give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me introduce my guests. Jennifer Freed is a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon in Eugene. She joins us by phone. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. Elizabeth Letourneau is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. She joins us today. Thank you for being with us today.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
You're welcome. John Q. LaFond is professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's also the author of Preventing Sexual Violence, How Society Should Cope with Sex Offenders, just published in January. He joins us from KCUR in Kansas City. Thank you for talking with us today, Professor LaFond.
Glad to be here.
Jennifer, let me talk to you first. You write that child sex abuse is reported by just 20% of women and 5% of men. That's amazing that so much of that is happening.
Yes, it's shamefully frequent, and it's happened to these large numbers of people, both here in the USA and worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Frido, you also say, though, that much of the, as you said, goes unreported, and there's probably a lot more of it going on there.
That's correct. If you look at the figures for what gets reported to law enforcement or Child Protective Services and compare that to what's known to be occurring from other sources, the estimate is that approximately only 10% is getting reported, leaving 90% unreported to law enforcement.
Wow. Well, so let's talk about the definitions first. What constitutes child sexual abuse?
Well, the numbers that I was just referring to use a definition typically focusing on contact abuse. So this is where there's touching occurring between an adult and a child. Mm-hmm. And there's also non-contact abuse, but that's typically considered somewhat a separate problem. Within contact abuse, there's penetration and there's non-penetration. And when cases are reported to law enforcement, it's usually about 50% of the cases involve some form of penetration.
Mm-hmm. So just to get the Michael Jackson case out of the way, that seems to be, like, from reading your statistics, something totally different than most cases of child sex or alleged child sex abuse.
The Michael Jackson case is different in a number of ways. One of the most important facts that research has uncovered is that most abusers it's more mundane. They're well known to the child. They may be in the family or otherwise well known. They're not strangers, and they're also not celebrities.
Mm-hmm. You say that, yeah, most people know are well known. 80% or more or higher are well known to the people who it occurred.
Yeah, it's very high.
Yeah. Is there any way to prevent this abuse from happening in the first place? Can we tell in advance, who might be a sex abuser?
Yes and no. One of the things I think is really important to realize is that child sexual abuse is both a crime and a serious public health problem. And when we think about prevention, we really need to think about it as a serious public health problem. Prevention will and should occur early in education and be continuing throughout education. And in the long run, looking at it this way is going to reduce the incidence much more than focusing on the individual cases that come to our attention, because they are, in fact, only the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, Elizabeth Letourneau, is there a model for a sex abuser? Do they fit in any patterns?
In terms of, is there sort of a profile of
yes.
sex offender?
Yes.
No, there really isn't. As Jennifer was saying, they are often well known to the individual. They can be anyone. They can be siblings, caregivers, uncles, teachers. They are often portrayed in the media as strangers who were very dangerous, but that's 10% or fewer of the offenders. And so you can't look at a group of people and say, this guy is more likely to be an offender than mm-hmm. this guy. There's just no way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There are some risk factors that put people at risk for offending, but they're not very specific to sexual offending. They tend to be specific to either delinquency in the terms of juvenile offenders or to criminal offending in general in terms of adult offenders.
Mm-hmm. Are there just some people who are one-time sex abusers, or are most people repeaters?
No, I would say there certainly are people who are one-time offenders. There are people who have deviant sexual thoughts that they never act on in the first place. There are some people who are opportunistic offenders who may offend only because an opportunity presented itself and they were reasonably sure they wouldn't get caught and they acted on it. And then there are some people who have strong arousal to children or to violence and who prefer that kind of sex and who seek it out frequently.
Mm-hmm. John LaFon, what happens when people who have been sexual offenders are released from prison? Do most of them molest again?
Surprisingly, sex offenders as a group have a very low recidivism rate compared to other offenders. For example, a 1998 meta-analysis combining studies of sex offense recidivism reported a rate of 13.4% over a 4 to 5 year period. That means about 13% of this large group of sex offenders released back into society committed another sex crime during a 4 or 5 year follow-up period, and that's quite low. So I think the public probably has an exaggerated sense that sex offenders as a group are particularly dangerous. Having said that, there's a small group of sex offenders who are in fact quite dangerous and do need much more of our attention.
But they all get tarred with the same brush, painted with the same brush.
That's right. I mean, we have to accept that most sex offenders will be released back into society, and most sex offenders will not reoffend. What we need to do is to concentrate on the dangerous sex offenders and manage how we release them back into society.
Do we have research? Do we have science that would tell us which are the more dangerous ones? I'll ask that to all my guests. Yes.
This is Elizabeth. We do have emerging science that helps. We have measures called risk assessment tools or actuarial risk assessment tools that are reasonably good at identifying known offenders who are at high risk for reoffending sexually or just generally going out and committing other crimes.
Mm-hmm. John, you were going to say something also.
No, much of the same thing. Yeah. You can do an evaluation of risk based on past historical factors, and you can identify a group of offenders who have a high propensity to reoffend. And those, I think, are the offenders that we ought to pay most attention to.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen, I'm hearing you say.
I think the critical mistake in our legal strategies is that we consider all sex offenders to be equally dangerous, and they are not. And we pass laws that apply to all sex offenders and assume that all sex offenders will reoffend, rather than spending our limited resources on that much smaller group of sex offenders who pose a serious risk of reoffending, and we release those people, for the most part, back into the community without effective supervision or control.
Mm-hmm.
Can I jump in here?
Please. I was about to ask you.
Yeah, a couple points I want to make. One is that when looking at recidivism or reoffending, one of the complexities is how one knows if there has been a reoffense. And one of the things that worries me is that if the reporting rate is so very low, it may be that there's a lot more reoffending than is getting measured by many of the techniques. It's also the case that when offenders are tracked for a longer time, those rates, of course, go up because they have more time in order to get caught reoffending. Another thing that I wanted to add related to your question about what can we do and so on is that to look not just at the risk factors for particular individuals, but to look at more at the societal level. because child sexual abuse is so hidden from our vision in a number of ways, both because people don't disclose and because we tend to turn a blind eye on the problem, we are not given the kind of scrutiny we need to give to the social factors that allow this terrible problem to go unabated.
For example?
Well, I would first of all talk about silence. If you think about it, if people cannot talk about this and feel so afraid, feel they won't be believed, feel they'll be punished, then the very problem isn't getting disclosed. And without disclosure, victims can't be treated, offenders can't be brought to justice. There's also a related problem, which is the way an institution or a larger social group can, in some sense, condone the behavior by not explicitly saying it's a problem. And you see this in cases where there are institutions and child abuse seems to have really gotten out of hand. Often that's going along with an unwillingness to address the problem, even covering the problem up. If we talk about it and if we really shine a light on this problem, we're going to greatly increase those forces that will make it possible for victims to talk and make it less possible for offenders to believe this is okay behavior.
Mm-hmm. Should it be treated more then as an illness, like we think of alcoholism now or depression, and years ago we never thought of them that way?
Well, it is a crime, but it's also a serious public health problem. I think it's both. It's a light, like light, it's a wave and a particle. I think one of the things that we get a lot of attention on very sensational cases like Michael Jackson right now, but what we don't look at is the much more typical mundane context in which this crime usually occurs. I think we also tend to not be aware of just how dreadfully harmful this is. If you think about those numbers, 20% of females and 5 to 10% of males, and you think of, well, what if they had like a disease like that? What should we as a society be doing? This is really a relevant issue because we know this, experiencing this crime is very harmful. It affects behavior. We know it increases the risk of suicide, smoking, substance abuse, risky sex, even HIV contraction and criminality. It's highly associated with mental health problems that we are all concerned about, like depression, anxiety, and PTSD. And even, amazingly, chronic health problems in adulthood are related to a history of child abuse.
Dr. Letourneau?
I think I absolutely concur with what Dr. Fried was saying. And, would want to point out that with juvenile sex offenders in particular, treatment has done a better job of addressing, of taking an ecological approach to addressing the causes of the behavior and not focusing so much on individuals. With treatment of adult offenders, we tend to focus only on individual characteristics of the offenders, but in the juvenile field, we've gotten better at looking at, what places youth at risk, both in terms of their own individual characteristics, such as impulsivity, but also family characteristics like low parental monitoring, high violence in families, low parental caregiver youth warmth, peer characteristics like hanging out with deviant peers, and school characteristics, having a poor caregiver-school link and poor school achievement. All of those things place youth at risk for delinquent behavior in general, but also sexually delinquent behavior.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about sexual child abuse this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. It's interesting that you pointed out, or it was pointed out, that shining a light is what's needed here, but it seems to me one of the problems you have is if someone feels that they are a sex abuser themselves, where could they go to tell someone this and without the fear of being arrested? If you're looking for treatment, you go to a psychiatrist or a therapist. You say, I'm fearful that I'm going to harm someone. Isn't it incumbent on the therapist to then report you to the police?
It is. There are mandated reporting laws, and that's where this country has not yet been able to take a public health approach to sex offending. We take pretty much solely a legalistic approach to it, and it does make it difficult for there are men who want help, and it's difficult for them to find it without also risking substantial incarceration and even post-incarceration legal consequences.
Mm-hmm. Ira, we make that same mistake, though, I think, when we release sex offenders back into the community. 50 states have mandatory registration laws. They also have community notification laws. 13 states have passed laws that prevent sex offenders from living within 2,000 feet or so of daycare centers, schools, and parks. Other townships are considering exclusion zones in which sex offenders simply cannot walk. I think we have to do a much better job of managing the release of sex offenders back into the community with both strong control components and treatment components that are monitored, rather than basically trying to make them into wandering Dutchmen who cannot establish a home life, cannot get a job, cannot see treatment providers, and simply we basically make their rehabilitation and reintegration into the community very, very difficult.
You have some communities have started a program called community containment. Is that what you're talking about here?
Yes. Colorado has a program which combines a team of a specially trained parole officer, a qualified treatment provider, and a lie detector operator. And they sit down with individual offenders, gather a lot of information from the offender, find out his patterns of criminal activity, and they then construct a tight monitoring plan that denies him access to victims in the community. The parole officer supervises him and will visit his home unannounced. He must go to the treatment provider, and the treatment provider will disclose to the parole officer if he's not complying with the terms of parole. And even the polygraph operator can and will report noncompliance. In those cases, conditions of parole are made more stringent or in some cases even provoked. So there are ways in which we can let sex offenders live in the community but also protect the community in an effective way.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Laura in Virginia. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have a question. All those treatments and everything, when they don't work, why not sterilization? Especially considered, you know, the hardcore sexual offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, there is an argument in Michael Jackson's trial that Macaulay Culkin was not molested by Mr. Jackson. But of course he wouldn't molest everybody.
All right, stay with us. We're going to have to take a short break and come back and get those answers and take more of your questions. So don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about child sexual abuse. And, of course, when we always talk about issues of great import and affect people, a lot of people want to call in and ask about personal experiences. And as a rule, we don't think it's ethically correct that we can ask our guests to talk about you in particular. But we have on our website, if you go to sciencefriday.com, a couple of links there that might help you if you're looking for some help. Also, there's a really interesting link. I don't know why the city of Fargo, North Dakota, has put up such an excellent website on the mythology of sexual abuse, but we have that up on our website also. All right, as I said, we are talking about it this hour with my guests, Jennifer Fried, professor of psychology at the University of Oregon, and Eugene Elizabeth Latorno, assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. John LaFond is a professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of Preventing Sexual Violence, How Society Could Cope with Sex Offenders. Before I broke away for that break, we had a listener who was calling in and talking about why not castration. Anybody want to take a...
Well, I will comment on that. 5 states now have laws that, in fact, provide for what's called chemical castration of sex offenders. That is, a number of states will not parole sex offenders into the community unless they take drugs that eliminate or reduce their sex drive. And in one state, Texas, will allow inmates to actually, sex offenders, to have surgical castration on a voluntary basis. It will have no effect on their sentence or release from prison. In my judgment, the chemical castration laws are unconstitutional and should be struck down as both cruel and unusual punishment and as violating important fundamental rights. But those laws have not yet reached the higher courts.
Mm-hmm. I think the, I mean, people are very, very concerned about this problem in their neighborhoods. Are they? Do you think they're overreacting when someone who is a known abuser who gets out of incarceration moves into their neighborhood? There are cases where people put up signs on, you know, telephone poles, things like that. Do people overreact? It would seem, you seem to be saying that from the statistics, the pure statistical point of view, they are.
Well, I think there is certainly a problem of vigilantism and community anxiety when people in the neighborhood find out that there's a registered sex offender living in their midst. And as I say, statistically, there is not a great chance that that offender is going to reoffend. And I think coming back to something Jennifer said earlier, my other concern about this is that much of the publicity today directs people's attention to strangers. And the real threat comes from people close to them. And I think we are missing where we ought to aim our preventive measures.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth.
Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Sure. The other aspect that's also been touched on is, you know, you may know a couple of sex offenders who have been identified by your state, and you may know where they live because their registry is available on the internet, but you don't know the vast majority of sex offenders who are not reported to the authorities. And so another concern about this type of community notification, the sort of very broad community notification of having internet-based sex offender registries, is that people may feel it does increase community anxiety, but it also might make people feel comfortable if they don't think there's any sex offenders around them, and that's just not the case. It's a widespread problem. Offenders come in every shape and size, and we don't know who the majority of them are. And so, prevention would be much more preferable to this sort of post-intervention heavy focus on the people who are known to be offenders. That said, I think registrations do provide some help to police departments who are trying to find alleged perpetrators, but the broad levels of community notification, where particularly in states that don't distinguish between high-risk and low-risk offenders, probably do more harm than good and certainly need to be researched more.
There really is no sound research that I'm aware of that establishes that either mandatory registration or community notification either prevents sex crimes or assists in their investigation and solution. And this is one of my main concerns about misdirected efforts. Registration and notification costs a lot of money. We subject all sex offenders to registration, many sex offenders to notification, and I think that money and energy could be better spent on the high-risk sex offenders supervising in the community and having the state actually take responsibility for them rather than releasing them into the community and saying, here they are, take care of yourselves.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hi. I was calling because I am a forensic psychiatrist, and I do treatment of sex offenders within my private practice. And one of the things that I did want to mention was that there's a difference between sex offenders. Not all sex offenders have what we would consider psychiatric illnesses in the form of paraphilias. And I guess in this specific case, we're talking about the case of pedophilia. There are sex offenders who offend who don't have what we would consider a treatable illness. And another thing that I should mention is that in the way of sex offender treatment, we do have some very good new treatments that are available. They've been extensively studied in Canada, and they're making their way in the United States at this point.
Are these pharmaceutical treatments?
These are pharmaceutical treatments. I'm talking about the specific medication Lupron. It's an anti-androgen treatment that essentially causes, it's the same as chemical castration, but at the same time, it's not a physical castration. It's completely reversible, and it's, in my experience, it's been effective in conjunction with psychosocial therapies as well.
Does this take away the impulse away, or just the fact that you can't culminate the act?
Actually, it does both. It substantially decreases the impulse, sexually deviant impulses, and also can affect the actual ability to culminate the act. Of course, the nice thing about taking away the impulse is it's not just, we're not talking about just contact and penetration, but we're talking about decreased recidivism as far as being tempted. to act upon those urges. Mm-hmm. It seems to, and also it seems to preferentially, in my experience, it seems to preferentially affect the urges more than deviant urges, more than healthy urges, although it definitely can affect those as well.
Dr. Letourneau?
The research on treatment effectiveness is pretty sparse. Canada does do a better job of conducting this research. They have more funding for it than the United States, and so more research has been coming out of Canada in the last probably 5 or 10 years. There are a couple of randomized clinical trials, which are the gold standard for research on treatment effectiveness when you randomly assign subjects to a treatment group and to a control group. That's the, for example, most people are familiar with randomized clinical trials for pharmaceutical treatments. In psychotherapy or psychological interventions, there's two randomized clinical trials on the prevailing treatment model for adult sex offenders, which is a cognitive behavioral intervention that really focuses on the individual characteristics of the men. And neither of those randomized clinical trials supported the prevailing treatment model. Two trials isn't enough to generalize, but it wasn't very, neither study was very supportive of the prevailing treatment method. A broad meta-analysis of many more studies, most of which did not include random assignment, did support treatment and found about a 10% sexual recidivism rate for treated offenders versus a 17% recidivism rate for untreated offenders. And so less sophisticated research supports the prevailing psychological treatment model, but the more sophisticated randomized clinical trial doesn't. Mm-hmm. That's for adults. For juveniles, two randomized clinical trials do support a very intensive home-based treatment that targets juveniles and their caregivers, peers, and school relationships. That's called multisystemic therapy, and those are the only two randomized clinical trials in the juvenile sex offender field. The more common prevailing cognitive behavioral treatment that most juvenile sex offenders receive has never been subjected to a randomized clinical trial, and so at this point we don't actually know if it works or not, even though we've been using that treatment for a quarter of a century.
Do most sex offenders get treatment?
Certainly those who are identified.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Go ahead, John.
Then we'll go back to Jennifer.
I mean, most sex offenders, if they're going to get treatment, will get it in a prison setting. And, in fact, most states have been cutting back on their prison treatment programs. Some states have waiting lists for their prison treatment programs. And I think part of the get tough, harsh punishment approach to sex offenders implies that they are not sick or needed treatment. And to that extent, I think some states are not providing the kind of treatment, at least to those sex offenders who want it, while they are in prison. And as soon as they go into the prison system, when there's a good chance of changing those attitudes and behavior patterns that lead to sex offending.
Go ahead. Do you want to say someone who was...
Yes, Jennifer wants to say something. I think there one of the most difficult aspects of dealing with this topic is not getting distracted by fascinating issues that are not actually sort of the most representative. And because so few sex offenders actually get identified or seek treatment, we're actually talking about a very small percentage. And while it's really important to develop treatments for that small percentage, it's just a tiny bit of the problem. We really have to look at this as a public health problem with the vast majority of offenders not coming to the attention of either the medical or the legal world, and instead being out there in the community. One of the things that's so striking about what's going on in our country and how we're spending our research dollars is the tiny amount of research investment we're making towards this problem. It has been estimated, a conservative estimate, is that for every $100 of costs to society and victims for child abuse, we're putting in 5 cents, one nickel, in comparison to, say, a problem like cancer, which is also a terrible problem, but for every $100 in cost, we're putting in $2 in research. So we need to do a lot more to address this at a societal-wide level. And this will include, once we have this sort of support, will include getting better treatments and researching better methods of prevention, but it will be much more widespread a solution than just looking at those people who've come to our attention.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about sex abuse, childhood sex abuse this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. From what I hear you saying is that we don't know who the people are until after they've done something, or these people may have done something. We'll never know who they are because it goes unreported. But we're never going to find out at the rate that we're doing it who these people, you know, how we might stop some of these people before they commit a crime.
Well, we don't know who they are right now. Mm-hmm. But if we have a prevention strategy in place that starts early in middle school with teaching kids about good dating tactics, in high school that starts to teach them about coercive sexuality, both potential victims and potential offenders, what is harmful, what's not harmful, I think we have the opportunity to really put a serious dent in how many people evolve into these dangerous offenders that we are so fascinated by when they do come to attention.
Dr. Fried, you proposed in a paper in Science, the journal Science, that a new institute be an Institute of Child Abuse and Interpersonal Violence within the NIH be established.
Yes, I think that this would show a true societal and government commitment to this problem. Currently, the government does have programs, obviously, to address the problem of child abuse and more generally interpersonal violence, but these programs tend to be scattered across different parts of the government and quite small in each individual program. And while they're definitely heroes in each of these small programs, they are fragmented, and there's severe underfunding for the programs in particular and at the whole problem. An institute would be a way to really focus attention on this problem, coordinate, disseminate the research we do have. I mean, there is a lot of good research. It tends not to be easy for people to find it because we are so underfunded, but this would be a way to allow dissemination of what we have, identify the gaps in knowledge, and then really focus on filling in those gaps so that we have research on the causes and the consequences and prevention and treatment.
And just having an institute would give it notoriety in terms of something that has to be taken care of.
Absolutely. It would increase the visibility very much.
And have you gotten any reaction from anybody in the government who might be in, you know, the power to create such an institute?
I've had a reaction that this is a wonderful idea, and surprisingly, I have not had anyone tell me that it's not a wonderful idea. But, of course, an idea can be wonderful. What we really want to do is make this happen, and we have a lot of work in front of us in order for that to occur. But I really think the opportunity to discuss it like this is part of what will make that happen.
John LaFond, any reaction to this idea?
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. We spend so much of our anger, our energy, and our frustration on people who have been brought to the attention through the criminal justice system, and we tend to try to, quote, solve the problem by essentially confining large numbers of sex offenders for long periods of time. And we really need to start getting at what you might call the causes of sexual deviance and sexual violence. And they include, I think, cultural causes also, such as attitudes towards sex and male attitudes towards females. And I think you're, generally speaking, much better off trying to prevent these terrible crimes from happening before they do.
Dr. Letourneau?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with focus on prevention. And, you know, unfortunately, early prevention efforts were targeted at children in the case of child molestation, and children have no control over what happens to them. They can't say no to adults. We train them not to say no to adults. They're very easily intimidated. They're very easily tricked. We also geared a lot of our prevention programs to adult women, and you might improve one woman's ability to stay safe from strangers, which of course is the rare form of attack, but if someone wants to attack a woman, they're just going to go find another victim. So those programs don't actually reduce the likelihood of victim, reduce the rate of victims. They just change who gets victimized. And so more recently, there's been some prevention efforts targeting adolescent boys and trying to figure out who among them are at higher risk for developing inappropriate sexual behaviors. And I think that's definitely where we want to go, is try to target the kids that are at highest risk for actually developing some of these behaviors. And it's hard to do because not too many kids will. Yeah. But you can do, I think, broad prevention efforts if we can get them started in schools, that's going to have the biggest bang for the buck.
We've run out of time, and we will keep track of this and come back as we can. Thank you very much for all of you for joining us. Jennifer Fry, Professor of Psychology, University of Oregon in Eugene. Elizabeth Letourneau, Assistant Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. John LaFon, Professor of Law, University of Missouri in Kansas City. And thank you all for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Today.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and Senior Producer Karen Berghoff. Charles Berquist is our director and web producer. Our intern is Todd Neal. I mentioned a lot of links today. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have some help for you if you need it. We also have links to how to recognize and be educated about sexual child abuse. So we'll have to say goodbye for this hour. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.